You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, February 27th. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Monday, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartlands of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Bhaskar Sankara, Comrade Sankara from the Jacobin magazine, in the light of the DNC chair race, the ongoing rampage of clown fascism in this country, we ask, is Marxism the only antidote, at the very least radical, for real social democracy? We'll get to that, how the Democrats are failing, how Trump, in some ways, is not quite at his most dangerous, even as he and this crew of demented people and white supremacists and corporate cronies are destroying the country and the planet. Also, Trump at CPAC, not so concerned about the First Amendment, and really is tired of those just sources, anonymous and otherwise. Time to print him up a stop snitching tea. And Germany's far-right neo-Nazi party looks to be faltering. Why? Well, there's an internal division between some who want to rebrand the party in the light fascism mold of the National Front, and another major party leader who said recently that Germany needs to stop apologizing for its Nazi past. Make Germany great again, apparently. Reince Priebus and Sean Spicer pressure the intel community and then quote themselves to discredit stories on Russia. Tom Perez at the DNC, and hate crime in Kansas. Presumably a white supremacist opens up fire at a bar, attempting to kill a couple of Indian men, kills one, injures another. Heartbreaking, we'll hear from his wife. Of course, that has nothing to do with what's emanating from this administration. Steve Mnuchin says that entitlements are not going to be cut for now. And now, Trump administration officials will no longer make a commitment that their plan to replace Obamacare won't kick people out of healthcare. It's still going to be better. But better from some people might mean nothing. And Sebastian Gorka has been very upset by a certain Twitter feed. And we have recording of that. We're back live, obviously, everyone. Moonlight took Best Picture. I didn't see any of the other nominees, but I did see Moonlight. And I hard for me to imagine that anything. That truly was one of the best movies I've ever seen. Also, I think it was Hell or High Water, which was much less sort of, that was more of a sleeper movie, the kind of unofficial sequel to Sicario and this kind of trilogy of Borderland movies. That movie was amazing. On the movie tip, we're not going to play the screw up where they announced La La Land, mainly actually because it's funny for a guy who busts out a lot of incest jokes. I find situations like that extremely uncomfortable to watch. I don't enjoy that. Like I even just watching a clip, because I didn't watch the Oscars because I was flying. Watching that clip made me really uncomfortable.
Of what? Them just
announcing La La Land. They didn't just make a mistake.
I didn't watch it.
Yeah, see, this is what I thought too from the headlines. I thought it was like, okay, he said La La Land and he corrected himself. They announced La La Land and the crew came up to take the award.
Can I describe what happened?
Yes,
since you guys are like faltering a little bit.
Ooh.
They gave Warren Beatty.
Wait, hold on. All right, yes, go ahead.
They gave Warren Beatty the wrong envelope. It was the best lead actress, and Emma Stone won that for La La Land. So it said La La Land, so he looked confused for a moment. I did not watch, but I watched a clip.
Right.
He looked confused. He announced it. La La Land's crew came up.
Right.
Did a couple acceptance speeches. Somehow got the other envelope, and one of the producers was... It was actually very genuine, and it was kind of cool because he was like, stop, this isn't a joke. Moonlight won.
Wow.
We didn't win. Moonlight won. This isn't a joke. Come up to the stage. And
so is it?
It sounds
so,
like
I just
a joke.
Ask, it sounds staged.
I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous.
I don't believe it.
No,
I mean,
I don't know. But why would they stage that?
For publicity.
Because, yeah, exactly. Like Steve Harvey just did this.
The Academy does not take it.
Steve Harvey jokes were like immediate.
I don't think that the Academy is sort of humorous enough about itself to do something like that. But
I mean, I'm just suspicious is all I'm saying.
The other thing about it is that I haven't seen either film, but
I like how Matt just goes like Kennedy on everything. He's just like, I want to know. I want to see a side shot. I want to see a slow-mo. Look at Beatty's face back and to the left.
So DiCaprio holding the envelope.
And to the left.
Well, the other thing about it, I started saying, I haven't seen either film, but
gotta see Moonlight. I will say that.
I'll see both of them eventually, but, La La Land, you know, just from reading some of the things, is extremely problematic in the sense that it attempts to give a bit of history of jazz with Ryan Gosling as the lead character. I mean, that should be disqualifying in my mind as it being a great movie, period. I'm sorry. Like, it shouldn't win Best Picture. That's just, it's not right. It's wrong.
Bum rush the stage.
Me?
Yeah. It's not right. Not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients make a real difference. So it's important to know where your food comes from. You know what I'm talking about, everybody. I'm talking about Blue Apron. The great Blue Apron. Thankfully, for less than 10 person per meal, Blue Apron delivers easy-to-follow recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients, courtesy of over 150 local farms, ranches, and fisheries across the United States, and right to your door. And because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, there's no food waste. It's everything you need to make sustainable, delicious, home-cooked meals in 40 minutes or less. Here are some of the meals that are available in February. Cashew chicken stir fry with tango mandarins and jasmine rice. Udon noodle soup with miso and soft boiled eggs. Roasted pork with apple, walnut, and farro salad. And crispy barramundi with quinoa and roasted carrot salad. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/majority. You'll love how good it feels and tastes. It creates incredible home cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/majority. blueapron.com/majority. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And I'm excited to talk about Skillshare because I am excited for my photography class, which I haven't had a chance to take yet. Several years ago, I have a really good friend of mine who's a photojournalist, and I went out with him for a day, or like, you know, an afternoon, basically just to kind of like shadow him and see what he does. And I've done a little bit of, you know, I've done some amateur photography, did a class in college, you know, or what did I do? It doesn't matter. I did a class on it somewhere. Which is clearly why I need an update. But I love photography and I want to jump into it more. And I will at Skillshare. Skillshare is basically a site where you can take courses on almost anything imaginable that you could be interested in with actual professional expert practitioners in the field. Film, photography, technology, business, design, culinary, crafts. It's a way of really getting expert, top-of-the-line mentorship. Membership includes access to over 14,000 classes. Classes for everyone, from freelancers to corporate entrepreneurs to help further your career, and just for fun classes like watercolor, crafts, or calligraphy. Self-guidance so you can learn at your own pace. Practice what you learn and get feedback. Class project in every class. Unlimited access to all of this for a low monthly price. You never pay per class again. Once you have the keys to the kingdom, you have unfettered access. If you're ready to excel, are you ready to accelerate your skill development? Go to Skillshare.com/majority to get your first month free. Get access to any class and any skill you want to learn or want to fine tune. That's another great thing about it. You can do it if from a sort of amateur, do something fun, develop a skill perspective, or it can really actually be relevant to something you're doing right now in your work that will improve your professional prospects. It's great. Get access to any class you want and learn want to learn or to fine-tune. Skillshare is giving my listeners a free month of access. Go to Skillshare.com/majority. That's Skillshare.com/majority. And maybe as a result of successful entrepreneurship classes you've taken at Skillshare or fine-tune your entrepreneurship skills at Skillshare, you're hiring. Or maybe you're just in any position where you're hiring, and that's why I got to tell you about ZipRecruiter. So you know where to post to find the best your job to find the best candidates. Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect candidate to hire, you need to post your job in all the top job sites, and now you can. ZipRecruiter has over 9 million resumes. That's insane. So you can search through their database. You can add multiple people to your account to make it the most efficient for you to find the best hire. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 200-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter. That's really big. I've actually been hearing more and more about people kind of finding the right person or the right situation through social. All with a single click. ZipRecruiter is a search engine for finding and posting jobs. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates. Rate them. Hire the right person fast. If you have any issues, ZipRecruiter's friendly and human support staff is ready to help you. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses. As featured in Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, The New York Times, TechCrunch, and CBS. ZipRecruiter's website shows trending fields, cities, and searches. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And one more time, try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. We will be right back with Bhaskar Sunkara on the Majority Report.
Tried to tell Nick in 2012, Nick, working hand to hand and no avail. Volume 1 was too heavy for you frail, Nick, so I got lean like codeine and pills. It's the visionary in the vintage Chevy. It's been a while, but wow, you still care. Free Nash till they pass out obituaries in bold caps. Your was not there. And I could do anything but move backwards. The hardest thing is to keep from being distracted. My big sister still claiming me on the taxes. Tell Uncle Sam I just need a second to add this. Gave my mama 10 racks and she packed and went to chew mash with it. Could dribble the work and gave me half of it. Half of it I tucked in the back of the air mattress. A quarter stash was stashed in the box with the Air Maxes. The rest got lost in sacks with my wife in no BM. Whack, dropping links in my DM. Bad been down in TL. I'm glad that you finally made it to the future, but you late and the price is through the roof. If you want, you could wait outside the building. I ain't taking no more meetings.
Stepped in the water. The water was cold. She healed my body, but not my soul.
I bring you greetings from the First Church of Boone Baptist, United Fellowship of Free Nationals, residing pastor is Dive Pack.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Bhaskar Sundkari. He's the founder of the Jacobin magazine. Bhaskar, how you doing, man?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me on again. You know, I love radio. I'm dressed here in Steve Bannon's bathrobe. It's great.
I don't love that image. I'm actually physically ill. Thank you for joining us. Thanks for joining us today, Bhaskar.
I'm fine with it.
Now I'm even more disgusted.
Thank you. I'm glad.
This administration is really pushing that, like, inside and outside, like, synchronized ugliness. Like, I mean, Bannon is grotesque, man.
Well, I mean, the main thing is, like, Trump had this image that he cultivated throughout the 80s
right.
and 90s of being just super well-dressed in his own kind of way, right?
Key term.
No, but having this
it worked,
like,
in the 80s.
We're going to wear a suit and tie everywhere. Right. Going to have the slick back hair, like a very kind of like New York Wall Street well-dressed.
Right.
Then I think Bannon is kind of encouraging him to let it slip a little bit. And soon you're going to see, you know, the president wearing, you know, his Make America Great cap with, like, you know, a jumpsuit or whatever. It'll be good.
I don't think that's going to happen. I see a Stop Snitching t-shirt in his future. That's what I'm holding out for, because he always bitches about sources. And I just want to see him, like, with a giant, like, Stop Snitching tee. And he could just, like, I mean, it's snitching. It's true. And they got to stop.
I think Steve Bannon is just drunk and bloated.
That's
correct. That's an opinion, for the record.
He could be.
Peter Thiel, if you're listening.
Could be better. Oh, drunk and bloated. Okay. All right. Before we get...
Bloomberg did a good profile of him, and they had photos of his house, and it's, like, painted in this, like, really bizarre, like, there's, like, wallpapers that are, like, kind of Revolutionary War regalia.
Of course.
And there's this image of him, like, kind of leaning over, like, a table of, like, 8 or 9 Breitbart, like, 20-year-old bloggers just kind of reading over, you know, his shoulder.
Yes.
Kind of gives you a sense of how the administration operates.
Yes, exactly. It's a bunch of, like, really bizarre, unhealthy people in their early 20s, and Bannon is just, like, floating in, like, this bizarre combination of, like, fake knockoff kind of, like, McMansion colonial America. But at the same time, he's also wearing, like, you know, like, ski trunks. Just, like, his guts just, like, popping
up. There was a giant portrait of Lincoln, which did surprise me. Like, I was expecting Jefferson Davis or something.
Maybe he watches. Maybe he has Lincoln up there to, like, know the enemy. Maybe he looks at Lincoln and he's like,
Karl Rove, like, still thinks of the party of Lincoln. Like, he actually believes that his favorite historian is, like, the quasi-Marxist Eric Foner. So I think there's, to some degree, the Republican intelligentsia still wants to think that they're, you know, that party still.
Well, they're both, and they also, and actually, well, this actually in a good way gets to where we're going in the first part of this conversation, because both Bannon and Grover Norquist, who is kind of, like, you know, not as dominant on the scene anymore, but they're both avowed admirers of Lenin. And, you know, I don't get too tripped out about these things. I don't think that Steve Bannon is a secret genius. I think he's got some savvy, which does stand out in this administration. I think a lot of some members of the Democratic Party they need to have Steve Bannon be a genius because it covers up how badly they effed up. But it is interesting that the identification with Lenin underlies the fact that it's crackpot thinking, it's racist, it's neo-fascistic, it's dangerous, it's stupid. But the Republican Party is still overall the home of, like, American radicalism at the highest levels. And, you know, why don't you comment on that? And then we'll get to, I'm using radicalism in a completely value neutral way. In this case, this is make things even worse radicalism. But when you have one party that is still stuck in this incredibly limited technocratic space, and then the other one is giving free range to all of, you know, everything from, like, you know, anime racist morons in their basements to, you know, guys like Bannon, who's like their godfather.
You know, there's a quote by Connor Kilpatrick in the latest Jacobin, where he says something to the effect of, you know, you have, like, you know, Trump basically retweeting, like, internet Nazis, but then the Democratic Party's candidates afraid of even embracing Scandinavian social democracy.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You know what? That's it. Exactly.
You know, so I think one is the Republican Party is the only kind of, let's say, value-driven party in the U.S. You know, you have the Democrats essentially just saying we can competently manage,
right,
and we're the sane people in the room. You know, we're the people you could trust. We're the people capital should trust. And capital, even though they preferred a lot of these, some of these promises and some of these policies from Trump, you know, it's telling they decided to go with the sure bet. They threw a lot of their money more towards Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. So
right,
it kind of worked for that crowd. It kind of worked for the, you know, rich people in suburbs like, you know, Fairfax, Virginia. But, you know, it didn't really compel anything, you know, in the American, you know, people. So a lot of us who voted for Clinton just did it, you know, purely defensively, whereas a lot of the people voting for Trump were kind of doing so, you know, quite a bit more affirmatively with kind of a sense of mission in mind. And, you know, I think that's the reason why they ended up, you know, squeaking out the victory. I would say this Bannon thing with Lenin does actually bother me. You know, I'm a democratic socialist. You know, I read Lenin, but I'm not, you know, I don't hold it as gospel, but I do think right, that the reading that, like, Norquist and, like, Bannon have of Lenin is essentially your, like, grade school history book reading, which you know, this guy just launched, like, was a really savvy, smart guy who launched a coup against the wishes of the people and, you know, managed to change the whole world as a result. So I think that's kind of the professional revolutionary kind of, like, caricature of what Lenin was actually doing is the Lenin that they embrace. You know, but it is telling that, like, these are actually kind of, for the first time in a long time, foes worthy of, you know, of us on the U.S. left. Like, you know, those of us who are trying to, like, push forward, you know, in my case, kind of an alternative socialist worldview and whatnot. It's like we've been
and
fighting.
And in my case, like a Stalinist one. I mean, I completely agree.
I mean, Stalinist is kind of soft. I consider you more of a Pol Potist.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, well, we're going to roll out the glasses thing. Like, I'm going to fast track Sam, obviously, but that's personal. The Pol Pot thing is a little bit, that's sort of phase two. But actually, we're going to get to the DNC race because that will, I think, you know, that will elucidate some of the stuff. But really briefly, a lot of people in our audience will know, you know, that this is like a grade school sophomoric reading of Lenin. But can you give, like, the brief sort of, like, Lenin for non-morons read and explain why it's a childish version
I would say, put it this way. And man, I did not know the Majority Report was going to have me talking about Lenin, but you know,
you never know, man.
I'll
have you talking about, you know, Carnival next time.
All of European social democracies was reading from the same playbook from the 1890s onward. So everyone wanted to build something like the German Social Democratic Party, which at that point was the, you know, largest organ trying to organize the workers' movement in Germany. They were pushing for democratic rights. They were pushing for more and more reforms. They thought they'd be running Germany as soon as the Kaiser, as soon as the monarchy kind of collapsed. And then obviously everything got derailed with 1914. What Lenin was in many ways trying to do was replicate the model of German social democracy, but in conditions of Russian illegality. When you're dealing with the Tsar, when you're dealing with, you know, thousands of people being thrown in prison or, you know, hundreds of people being killed or put into exile and so on. So that meant, in other words, that they had to have kind of a hard layer of people that were like full-time activists. And that's kind of been mistranslated into this idea of a professional vanguard party and so on.
Almost like they become like early adapters or something like that in our kind of late stage capitalist understanding. Yeah.
Right. But it was basically just German social democracy in Russian conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Then obviously after they took power, the country was a mess. And, you know, we could debate when it went wrong. I think it went wrong real fast.
Yes.
But up until that point, like, their goal wasn't to kind of see Hardin professional revolutionaries and launch a coup. Their goal was to try to organize workers, but it was really difficult to do so in conditions when that organizing was illegal. But so there's kind of this idea of, you know, Leninism as this, you know, kind of conspiratorial, you know, you get 10 people when you, you know, kind of change the world kind of thing. And to some degree, the right also has been doing this with Antonio Gramsci. You know, yep. The Christian right in the 80s and 90s love kind of quoting this, like, Wikipedia reading of him saying, you know, we're winning the battle for cultural, you know, hegemony.
Right.
And that kind of shit. It just makes him seem much, much sharper. But, you know, in fact, I think that they really, you know, don't have a fleshed out kind of view of this. I would say, though, this, like, in a certain way, my favorite novelists, a lot of them are, like, kind of, Burkeans, you know, a lot of them are just kind of reactionaries like the V.S. Naipaul, and that's sure. Only partial of the Trinidadian nationalism coming out.
That is a little, yep, you know, there you go.
In many ways, what I do, you know, admire about Bannon is that he's someone with a worldview. Mm-hmm. He's someone mm-hmm. like who has a sense of what he wants to do. I don't think I agree with you that he's not a genius when it comes to the day-to-day kind of tactical stuff and whatever. He's savvy, but not a genius, like you said.
Yeah.
But he does have this overarching worldview, which I don't think the kind of Mitt Romneys of the world did. Like, Mitt Romney just wanted to get rich and to help his friends get rich.
Yeah, and he did. It's just a really boring one. I mean, that it's a worldview that's like a hybrid of like Mormonism and a Boston Consulting Group, you know, forecast for, you know, Chinese imports. I mean, that, you know, that's it. Like, it's, there's some hybrid of kind of like personal temperance through religion, and then, you know, capitalism's awesome. I mean, that's it. I think, I mean, you're yep. right. These are definitely people that have a more, so let's then, and we'll loop back to this, because this is in some ways the question of this interview. Is it only Marxism that can beat Trumpism? And it is really funny as a tangent that, like, you have this culture in America that is definitely through, certainly, you know, Jackman's obviously part of it, and Bernie's campaign. You know, there's all these different ways in which the conversation has shifted. But you had, from, you know, many years, like, you have some very good academics, some very committed activists who were on the left, and as an example, like, reading Gramsci seriously. And the people that would be most dismissive and roll their eyes at those people the most would be, like, the democratic elite and the kind of technocratic sphere. And then on the right, meanwhile, you have the Wikipedia read, like you said, of people like Gramsci, because they're the ones who are actually, in their sort of rush and attempt to have some version of intellectual greatness. Well, who are you going to read? Like, you know, I mean, if you really want, I mean, I get, you know, I think, you know, even these guys have sort of graduated from, you know, Ayn Rand, like, dime store, you know, novel sociopathy, and they want to get some actual cred. So they're actually trying to cloak themselves a bit in the, you know, in the cloak that the center left would actually much more readily dismiss, which is interesting. But you wrote a piece a couple weeks ago where you said that in order for resistance to work, organizers basically need to ditch the establishment, establishment Democrats. And we had this DNC chair race that happened over the weekend, and I want to just lay out a couple of caveats, because I do think that everybody of all persuasions, there's way too much of an outrage culture, and I don't actually know in actuality. Like, Tom Perez and Keith Ellison, I clearly and distinctly preferred Keith Ellison, but I don't. This actually, in fact, wasn't even Bernie versus Hillary. The nod from the establishment perspective is that Tom Perez is a liberal part of the establishment, and he did do some very good things on civil rights, on labor enforcement, and everything else, right? But at the same time, it clearly was another nod that the powers that be presently in the Democratic Party, and I don't think it's just ideological, I think it's, you know, making sure the right people get consulting contracts, are not comfortable with even a kind of like soft liberalism that has some genuine kind of grassroots emphasis. So I want your read on that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say this. It was a proxy battle between different wings of the party. And Tom Perez was a person that the kind of Obama-Clinton establishment wing put forward.
Right.
Out of all the people they could have put forward, he was in many ways one of the least odious.
Yep.
You know, they knew they couldn't provoke us too much,
right,
which is a sign of progress.
Right.
But, you know, nonetheless, I don't buy the reading that, you know, Perez and Ellison have a lot of the same program, because to begin with, Ellison was laying out kind of an alternative vision of a different sort of DNC, one that kind of encouraged and helped feed into the kind of this resistance we're seeing to Trump, one that had this kind of left populist alternative, you know, one that was just more combative and, you know, just encourage people to actually get involved at a deeper level than what we've seen.
Yep.
Perez, I think, at least from what I've heard, you know, I've listened to multiple interviews, but I haven't dissected every word that he said during the DNC race. I was offering a far more kind of contained, lots of kind of platitudes about, you know, being more competitive and doing better and things like that without any kind of clear understanding. Obviously, he has connections with segments of the trade union movement through his time as labor secretary, and he wasn't a bad labor secretary as far as, you know, U.S. government labor secretaries go.
Right.
But yeah, overall, it's hard to see this as anything but the establishment of the party saying, you know what, this Bernie thing is a flash in the pan. It's still our game. Mm-hmm. We're still going to handle this in 2018 and 2020, and we don't actually need to radically reshape things. You have a couple establishment voices that I think are, you know, just for purely crassly opportunistic reasons, are savvy enough to see the way things are going. Like Chuck Schumer, you know, this guy, if you live in New York, you know, one thing about Chuck Schumer is that he goes to wherever the kind of crowds are. He goes to wherever the cameras are, you know, and he himself is wherever direction the kind of tides are going. But it's telling that Chuck Schumer knew to embrace the Bernie wing of the party.
Yep.
It's telling that he knew to endorse Ellison.
Right.
But, you know, I think he's the exception in the Democratic establishment. These people aren't just going to kind of roll over and you know, give Bernie the and his people the party. So I think we need to think seriously about what it would mean to, you know, wage the kind of war against Trump while also making a two-front conflict against huge segments of the Democratic, you know, party establishment, which aren't going to effectively beat Trump, but I think we're seeing are going to actually oppose these developments within the party. They want different tactics compared to 2016. They want a few different tweaks, but they don't actually want a fundamentally different vision.
Right. So actually, and we'll get into that, but let's speaking of just sort of platitudes, let's listen. And I agree with you. I have no problem with saying in context, like as an example, I really wanted Hillary Clinton to pick Tom Perez as her VP, right? Like if he was her VP, that would have been an actual material difference from the misery of Tim Kaine. But it's always this sort of too late pattern, because I agree with you that there is a proxy dimension of this. But this is, let's just take a brief listen to Tom Perez's acceptance speech. And I think, you know, Bhaskar, whatever else we say about Tom Perez, I think we both have to acknowledge that he is an electrifying orator, or not.
We need a chair who can not only take the fight to Donald Trump, make sure that we talk about our positive message of inclusion and opportunity, and talk to that big tent of the Democratic Party. We also need a chair who can lead turnaround and change the culture of the Democratic Party and the DNC. And I'll tell you, folks, culture change has a number of dimensions, and all of them are essential. We must redefine the role of the DNC so that we're not simply electing the president, but we're working to elect from the school board to the Senate in all the states and the territories from Democrats abroad, making sure we elect Democrats. And the way we do that is to build strong parties, to organize.
I just want to say really briefly, I wish that we could completely let go of the term folks.
Yeah. I know.
Okay? That would be, that to me, if Tom Perez did that as leader of the DNC, you could say that if he banned that word, if you could say that I have low standards. But you know what? I would be totally supportive of his leadership. But anyways, Bhaskar, go ahead.
I don't know where this came from, this whole folks thing.
I actually think another thing that we can actually blame Obama for that. I think Obama's the modern
folks
guy.
I think on the left, organizers no longer wanted to say things like workers, but they also did, because they made them seem too kind of sectarian and out of touch, right?
Right.
But they also didn't want to, like, I don't know, they wanted something that still had kind of a radical twinge. So they went back in their kind of like Woody Guthrie days, you know, they pulled out some, like, you know,
Woody Guthrie.
But like working folk want an alternative. I'm like, yeah, working folk don't call themselves working folk. And neither do the masses. The masses don't call themselves the masses.
Right.
We should probably retire that one too.
I would say yes. But I mean, in those sort of outlines of platitudes right there, is that basically what you're talking about in terms of like the, there's no intellectual infrastructure there. I'm not talking like, obviously he's a smart guy, but the same tropes, culture change, opportunity, inclusion, take the message out, organize, 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 and win local elections are tangible things. Those are different things. But everything else reflects a culture. And again, this goes back to Bannon. He's a crackpot, I do not want to overstate his intelligence. I don't think it's that high. But it's the worldview of a strategist and someone with ideas versus just a PR consultant. And you can see that's the kind of still the thinking of these people.
Well, listen, I think there's different consensus. There's different wings of kind of like neoliberal consensus, right? And Bannon captured some of it when he said that, you know, they believed that we were, you know, essentially just a global marketplace, not, you know, a nation that happens to have an economy. You know, that this America kind of has a reason for being outside of its economy. And obviously the way he's framing this is in kind of a right wing nationalist direction, but it is kind of something that's value driven. And you saw, this was from Bannon at CPAC. You saw the next day Trump at CPAC, you know, echo a lot of the same rhetoric and mention that he thought Bernie was right on trade.
Right.
Now someone like Perez will look at that and say, well, in fact, you know, TPP or NAFTA might, you know, cost us 20,000 jobs, but it'll also create 30,000 jobs. And he'll try to examine this like it's just policy. It's like, but no, it's like people actually are against these things because they capture a lot of what they don't like about the last 20 or 30 years.
Right.
It's not the details of NAFTA. No one's sitting there looking at it line by line. It's what it represents. Something new that was pushed through that helped to reshape the economy that they had no power over. They weren't really consulting over. They were just kind of like, you know, lied about and told it would bring all sorts of benefits that a lot of people didn't see. And so it's a difference between constructing a politics and then letting the policy fall into place after that. And just thinking that politics is just the accumulation of little different policy points.
Go ahead. Finish your thought.
No, at some level, I think guys like Perez fundamentally want policies that are, you know, help a lot of ordinary people, ordinary folk, if you will. But the thing is, they
don't
have
say
a
it
very
again.
Narrow vision of what's possible, right? So they actually, in fact, fundamentally believe that the best you could hope for is something slightly more even, slightly more level, but basically, you know, has to offer essentially social inclusion, right? Excluded groups are now allowed into the marketplace and hopefully make the marketplace a little bit more fair. What Trump offers is like an alternative value system. And to some degree, you know, it's a nasty one.
Bhaskar, we're losing you. I don't know where you stepped.
It's a deep state, man.
It's a deep state. I was actually thinking it was, for you, it was Trinidadian intelligence.
I don't think we have much of,
you don't think
much of anything.
There isn't a Trini intelligence service? I don't know, man.
We did hire
Giuliani
as a consultant, and he bought this blimp, and he had this blimp circle around Port of Spain to look for like drug trafficking activity, and it was just a national joke for
that
a couple
is
of years.
The most
kind of money.
Giuliani thing I've ever heard. It is real. So no, I think and that's. There are two really, really important points here, Bhaskar, that we need to tease out. Because number one, I think you're completely right that the sort of the neoliberal, technocratic, democratic, you know, whatever terminology we're using, that cluster, is it confuses second order questions with first order questions, right? Like a second order question, and it is a legitimate question. This is where you and I are also distinct, obviously, from the right. We actually do care about how something is going to operationally and empirically work in the world, right? But that's not a primary motive. What works isn't a primary motive. Primary motive is, you know, mass justice. Primary motive is everyone has, you know, I mean, we're talking about very basic things. Primary motive is everyone has healthcare, period. No nonsense, no bullshit, right? The second order questions are, well, what does it look like and how is it delivered in some respects? And I think that, you know, that is the sort of thing with trade is even if your job was replaced, well, maybe you don't like the job that was replaced it. Or maybe even if it abstractly evens out because you're unemployed and there's nothing left in your community, but you have more purchasing power at Walmart, well, maybe you would have opted for that decision to begin, right? Like that does not capture us as full human beings, full citizens. It's just these economic abstractions that are also never going to be compelling to people other than like an incredibly small group of nerds.
Or beyond that, yeah. Let's say if it, over the course of the entire country, let's say, to use a made up number, gave 50,000 jobs distributed across the country. If it cost us 30,000 jobs in the same like three communities,
yeah, exactly.
Then of course that devastation is going to be a lot more palpable,
right? And and also like 30,000 jobs that are like that's what you do, and your skill is completely irrelevant now, and you're destroyed and gutted in three communities versus like 50,000 new like you know. Trading jobs that are sprinkled across the country. That's exactly right. And I think, and then that leads to the second point. And this actually, you can get as explicitly as you want into a kind of Marxist analytic framework. Part of the reason I think, and I don't know that you need, like, I don't know where this honestly goes as a political conclusion, but I just think it's reality. It's like, we're playing, if you're on any version of the left, from the you know center social democratic left to obviously a Marxist perspective, we're playing in terrain that fundamentally is synchronized with a different worldview. So we're a capitalist system, and that you know defines so much of what we conceive of as possible, even in our own imaginations, right? Like that's the kind of common critique. So when you have that dynamic, you can have one side where imaginations can completely run free. Like, well, maybe what we should do is we should turn schools into private prisons. And then we can have a lottery system for kids to escape prison if they do well on a test. And then a teacher could be shot. And then, you know, like they're constantly innovating.
Sounds like a Japanese game show.
It sounds like it does sound. Or like Betsy DeVos's new education brief, right? Like, so, and then on our side, it's like, well, maybe we can convince people that, like, actually, again, this is the inverse of NAFTA, that there'll be enough offsets by giving a poor kid an inhaler that will actually end up saving money and it's okay. Versus the logic that we want to follow, which is like, no, actually, it's just that there's no, even if giving every poor kid an inhaler was a completely inefficient thing that made no sense and did not save money, it still must be done.
Right, exactly. And I think part of it is we believe that changing the world and just at the very least creating a basic welfare state, a basic, you know, condition where people have access to housing and education and all the other base necessities of life is, you know, possible. We don't know exactly how necessarily, right? We're not writing, we don't have the pre-written policy points down to like 30, 40 pages.
Right.
But we know, richest country on earth,
right.
It's doable. It's
exactly.
Possible. We've seen it done even in places that are a lot poorer, you know, and a lot more, further behind than us. You know, we like to think of Scandinavian social democracy as being this kind of like pinnacle of human civilization. Like, but have you like seen their cuisine? You know, these are people like who went from like, you know, eating fermented fish to providing like world-class healthcare and education and things like that. So we know it's possible. In other words, We right. just like are going to figure out how to do it technically, of course, when we get to that point where we're in power. And we start, though, from explaining people our values and our politics. Whereas I fundamentally believe that even if Perez shares some of this social democratic vision, at least a little bit of it, he starts with kind of realism, right? Kind of mm-hmm. the prison of the possible. Yeah. And I think that's very different than what even Rove and some of these guys and even the Bush White House, not even the Trump White House, were saying. You know, a decade ago when they were saying that they create, or 2 decades ago, they're going to create their own reality when they get to power.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Do you think then that what does that start though? Because to me, like, I don't have any emotional attachment at all to the Democratic Party. I don't care. At the same time, you know, Bernie or bust and acceleration arguments, I'm sorry, they were, and will remain incredibly stupid. And from an electoral point of view, there isn't going to be a third party ready, as far as I can tell, for 2020 to get this guy out of office, which needs to happen. And at the same time, there does need to be this two-front war, both for the reasons we're outlining, which is like, we need to have a for real, no-nonsense social democracy in this country. And also because we're not even dealing with people. You know, there's two types of adversaries in the Democratic Party, as far as I'm concerned. You know, there's the ideological and political adversaries, and then there's also the, like, you know, and this from my perspective was always the thing with Hillary. It was like, I opposed Hillary in the primary because I am progressive and left, and I also had very serious concerns about her electoral performance, you know. So we need to kind of synchronize these two things, but I also think without getting into our own, you know, the opposite side of the prison of the possible, which is just fantasy life, which is like,
right,
there's gonna
exactly,
be this
exactly.
uprising and everything. It's like Democratic Party is still going to be the near-term national force that gets this catastrophe out of office. So how do we balance?
I remember in like 2004 or something, someone telling me that, hey, you never know what's going to happen. If we all vote are conscious and right. like, you know, do the right thing, that Dennis Kucinich can very well win this primary in like dead seriousness, you know?
Wow.
So I agree. There's this kind of like fantasy thinking. So I right. think that we need to think seriously about the barriers towards the type of politics we want. We need to think seriously about the barriers towards creating a third party, how they've been constructed, how they could potentially be undone over the long run, or how in the short term we kind of need workarounds.
Yep.
So I'm all for, in certain instances, running in Democratic primaries. The only thing is, I want those people running in Democratic primaries to be running with a clear kind of unified platform, to
yep.
be a part of some broader organization or yep. current, right? To run as Bernie Democrats, not just to run as capital P, you know, progressives.
Yep. Yep.
You know, so I think we need to think seriously about the barriers in front of us, of course, but at the same time, we need to expand people's horizon about what they expect of government, what they should demand of government.
Yes, exactly. And the final sort of thoughts I want to get from you, we had a conversation a couple of months ago where we dove deep into the Bannon worldview, and I remember both of us were kind of saying, like, he really is in many respects the most terrifying aspect of this administration, because you know, on one hand, it's like the next step of, you know, this sort of overt kind of white nationalism and anti-Semitism and everything else, but also because everything else is just shaping up to look like normal plutocratic, you know, extraction based. Throw people into meat grinders if it helps, you know, make, you know, Chevron stock price slightly better kind of Republicans. And he's the one who says, who has this very disturbing synthesis that he's at least offering on paper, which is far right kind of neo-fascistic nationalism. But, you know, I want to spend trillions of dollars on infrastructure, put people to work. I want to really rebuild the middle class. And we were, you know, both noting that this is the most terrifying scenario if Trump actually went in that direction. Now, it's my read that they're very much rhetorically still in that direction, but even this big infrastructure bill, it's not like, we're not talking New Deal, put people to work. We're talking typical corporate, throw a bunch of subsidies out, and meanwhile, at the same time, they're, you know, they're going to throw people off Medicaid. They're, you know, it's shaping up to look, even as the rhetoric continues, as just like the normal Republican savage war on everyone that doesn't own multiple homes. So it's terrible, well, but I'm less concerned about that synthesis right now. But I want your take on it.
I mean, for one thing, the cabinet is a regular Republican cabinet.
Yeah.
No more, no better, just a regular Republican cabinet with maybe a few kooky people like Betsy DeVos, you know, thrown in, right?
Right, right.
But, you know, there is this contradiction between that cabinet and that Congress with the rhetoric, right? Well, my worry is that they could still manage to push through some sort of infrastructure bill that delivers some of the goods, but not what they're promising. But they're able to kind of spin it as a big victory. And a lot of people might shrug and say, well, it's better than nothing. It's better than we got from the Democrats or whatnot, because they're combining it with this rhetoric that's almost like a working class identity politics, if that makes sense. You know, it's almost like they're going to valorize the American worker in these broad sweeping terms, even as they do nothing for the American workers, even as they push policies that continue to erode the kind of condition of the American worker. But it might just be enough for people who have been, you know, ignored or worse by the Democratic Party, that, you know, it might be enough to win certain people's loyalties. And I'm afraid that it will be, unless the Democrats can present some sort of left populist alternative in the vein of Bernie Sanders. So that's the real challenge, right? Whether or not we're going to go to war with you know, Cory Booker or, you know, someone from that kind of like ilk. Whether or not we're going to get, you know, kind of
you guys should become computer programmers. Sorry.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. We're going to have hackathons for Booker.
Right.
It's going to be great.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think just what you said right there is such a powerful cultural signifier. I mean, it, on one hand, it speaks to how disgusting it is in general, the sort of conditionality of most people in this country, and also the irony, you know, in some way, even the, like, one of the most successful legacies of the Obama administration is just expanding Medicaid. So ironically, like, you know, even where they, you know, are hitting their marks and deserve credit, it was actually just doing basic good liberalism. But just the notion that people are so under siege in a certain way that even just like the signifier of saying you do something that is worthy of respect. Now, you're still not going to be able to do it, and you're still going to be completely screwed. But instead of, you know, sort of telling you to do something else or dismissing what you used to do as useless, that cultural signifier can mean something. But I think we also have to acknowledge that that's also the part and parcel of a lot of, you know, very, very ugly and dangerous racism, xenophobia, and sexism as well. You know, it's part and parcel of the same package.
Right, but you can't just tell people to kind of retrain. You know, just
No, of course not. Like, no, that's what I'm saying.
City it's, and retrain, but,
yeah, it's
but, you know,
totally
that's,
condescending.
That's been where the Democrats have been at.
That's right.
And I do agree that you can combine this kind of particularly white working class identity politics, which is being constructed with a noxious program, and that's kind of the worst of both worlds.
Yeah.
Or you could present an alternative. That's why more than ever, I don't think the choice is between. I think it's too apocalyptic whenever Marxists say or socialists say this choice between socialism and barbarism. In the you know, long term, maybe. In the short term, I think the choice is between kind of Bernie Sanders style like populism and the continued descent into, you know, wherever Trump is going to lead us, which I guess is kind of a soft version of socialism or a soft version of barbarism. But, you know, that's where we're at. And I just don't see the space for the center. Like, I can't imagine a scenario where the Republican Party is back in control of Rubio, or where, you know, the Clintonites reassert their control of the party. It just seems to me less plausible than either extreme kind of gaining control.
I agree with you completely. And also, again, bear in mind, even that example is perfectly illustrative, because Rubio, you know, is actually programmatically on the radical right, and the Clintons are like that. The only thing that actually exists of quote unquote centrist politics today is in the green rooms of Morning Joe, a handful of Democratic political strategists and congresspeople, and a cluster of people who live in like Westchester and some other suburbs. There is no, the only reason it is represented with any kind of force in national politics is because the people who have it are, you know, disproportionately influential in terms of class position. That's it.
Right. And it's the same people who thought that, you know, the problem with Bernie was certain rhetorical things, or that he, right, you know, his emphasis on inequality was too white male, or whatever. You know, it's totally like a very small clique, yeah, of the media that overlaps, sure, with this professional managerial class and, right, this like professional political class. And, you know, I actually thought that they were more in touch than they actually were. You know, I thought, yeah, that they were going to, at the very least, be able to squeak out a majority in this election. But,
right,
you know, we're kind of seeing how detached this vision is. And we need to create an alternative one without just falling into kind of the, all right, you know, fuck it, you know, Breitbart, you know, whatever, you know, this kind of like fake news critique of it. We need something constructive.
I agree completely. Bhaskar Sunkara of the Jacobin, of the successor to CLR James. And partially just because there isn't really anybody in between that, you know what I mean? But it's still good props.
Oh, man. You know what? I'm more of a song and dance fan. I don't make a claim to having the ideas. I just, you know, vulgarize it for the Marxists. Yeah.
Well, I don't ever even attempt to have a vulgarize ideas competition with me, my friend.
Right, yeah, right. We'll do it.
Okay. All right. Well, bring
we'll
your...
We'll see how fast it gets corny.
Bring your impressions, Bhaskar.
That I won't do. Yes. That I won't do. I could make real epic impressions that I feel like you'd be too uncomfortable to make, and I might win that battle, though.
Then I really look forward to the next time we hang out. All right, buddy. I'll see you soon.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. Oh, okay, everybody. 646-257-3920. One second. 646-257-3920. I believe the IMs are on. Yes.
I just wanted to say to please go to nycpodfest.com. It's happening in April, and we have a live show that there are still tickets available for, and we would love to have everyone. It's a double billing, so we'd love to have as many Majority Report listeners there as we can, but there are also some other great shows that you could check out, and it's pretty cheap, and it's a cool thing. We did it a little bit last year, and it was very cool.
There you have it. Subscribe to Two Dope Boys and Podcast. Give the Majority Report a review on iTunes. Give Two Dope Boys a review on iTunes. Become a Majority Report member today. It's what sustains the show. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or a chocolate. IMs are on. The phones are on. See you in the fun half. Say it's an apple.